The following is one of the first podcasts produced on the Reasonable Voices podcast 8 years ago and features a marvelous group discussion of individual creativity featuring the founding members of TRV Podcast.
Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio comes to you to connect politics and finance, humanity and world peace, and the arts in a way that encourages all of us to think for ourselves so the best political and life choices are made by all. With artistic overtones, The Reasonable Voice is an advocate for a peaceful and prosperous world filled with creativity and political unity. I want to welcome today my guest, Mr. Drake Van de Castle. Drake Van de Castle. Love that name. Drake is the president of the First Knight Virginia. Drake, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Marcello. Glad to be on your show. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So, the First Knight Virginia is the second oldest of its kind in the nation, yes?
Yes, indeed.
And it's been running since 1983.
Yes, actually, it's kind of interesting. When we had another conversation briefly, that was the first year we brought it in. So actually, the event was on December 31st, 1982. So sometimes people get confused, and uh-huh. So we were bringing in 83. But yes, it's been a great event to be the second oldest in the country, and it's got a neat story on the seat of how it was created, because the first one was in Boston. Mm-hmm. And it is the largest in the country, and I think theirs has grown from a little over 100,000 to over a million.
Yes, tell us how it came from Boston to Charlottesville.
Sure. Well, there was a woman by the name of Nancy Rudolph who went to the first one in Boston and thought that Charlottesville would be a good place to recreate the event. Obviously not on the scale, we're not as large as Boston, nor do we have the footprint of Boston, but just a concept of having a alcohol-free event that is family-friendly and provides a broad base of entertainment for the public to kind of come together and celebrate the fact that the 1 year is wrapping up and getting ready to embrace the new year.
Excellent. So it is, when you say First Knight Virginia, you are talking about that magic time between New Year's Eve and New Year's Day.
Yes, indeed. And it's just an evening in celebration, and it's kind of expanded here. We'll never have the footprint of or the numbers of Boston. So when we started off, the first night was about 3,000 folks. It did grow over time and became much bigger. There were events out at St. Anne's, there were events down at UVA, there were Charlottesville Performing Arts Center. So at one point it got to be considerably bigger and broader, but over time I think the logistics became more difficult to pull it together in such a broad footprint. So we've just decided to focus and kind of get back to the roots, and everything we do is around the downtown mall within a short walking distance, so you can park once and walk to all of the events, and that's kind of what we wanted to do in that family friendly focus.
Well, tell us, because we have an audience out there that is not in Charlottesville, tell us something about the downtown mall and why it's such a perfect place for your and we should mention this is an arts festival, but we'll get into all that.
Sure, absolutely. No, the benefit is, like, our headquarters is at the Omni, which is at one end of the mall. We have events up near the pavilion. We're doing an event at the Discovery Museum and up at Key Rec. And so there's a bit of access, because it's a pedestrian-friendly brick mall that people can access. And then typically within a two-block radius, we have a variety of churches that are going to be open for our events. We have the Lighthouse Studio down near Water Street. So there are events that are both on either side of the mall that within a two-block radius that you can walk to. So we give some time in between the events for somebody to be able to go from point A to point B and to try and plan their evening so they can take in the variety of events that we have. So I think that's just one of the nice things. We try to appeal to all ages, from the youth and the kids all the way up to retirees and seniors, and something for everyone in between.
And your first night, Virginia, New Year's Eve to New Year's Day, non-alcoholic celebration, has been officially recognized by the city, yes?
It has. Actually, the city, when it was created back in 1982, as far as the pursuit of the event, it was with a declaration from both the city mayor and the board of supervisors for the county. And so at the time, I believe it was Francis Buck and Gerald Fisher came together and declared this kind of a joint official first night celebration for our area. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of continued and grown since then. And I think having been involved with it now for 5 years, it's something that it's a lot of fun to plan, in essence, a celebration. And it's always... the challenge always becomes a little bit of the weather factor, because you never know what weather's going to be like on December 31st.
Yes.
But all of our events are indoors, and so it's not as though there's outdoor entertainment. It's just more a matter of the reality sometimes of getting from point A to point B. But we've been very fortunate in recent years, and we've always held it. We've never been canceled by weather. And so we always encourage people, when they have considerations, is unless there is something which we can't physically make it happen, we usually try and push through. If it's a little chilly, just bundle up and enjoy, and know that they'll be inside and able to get warm to enjoy your performances.
Fantastic. Have you had any recognition from Richmond?
Actually, it's funny. In Virginia, some areas have had an attempted first nights, but they've come and gone. There is not one in Richmond.
Uh-huh.
And one of the neat things is we always get people who come from out of the area. I mean, I met a family last year who's come for the last 8 years as a family event to get out of Philadelphia and come down. They had some relatives here, and they enjoyed it so much they've kind of made it a family tradition to come down. So it's not only Charlottesville Mall, but we had people from Boston. They came down because they knew we were the second oldest and thought they would check us out. And actually, they were really positive, because it's so dense and intense in Boston, trying to get around. And I think they kind of enjoyed that everything is within such close proximity.
Fantastic. Tell me, have you been president for the past 5 years?
Actually, I came on the board, and then within the first year coming on board, I stepped into the presidency role.
Uh-huh.
Someone had a career shift unexpectedly, so there was a little bit of change on the board and stepped in, and I've just always kind of been passionate. I think it's a fun event, and I've enjoyed being involved with it, and we've had some great support along the way along those lines. I'll certainly give a quick shout out to Dwayne Cassis and Cindy Adams down with Carpet Plus. They've been a huge supporter on the board level, and that definitely made a difference, because there was a period where we struggled to continue to keep the event alive.
Mm-hmm.
And they came through in a big way and made a difference over a number of years. And I think now we're on a much better footing financially, and future looks bright.
Fantastic. How many presidents? Well, this coming first night, Virginia, is for 2013 to 2014. That's going to be your 32nd annual festival, arts festival here?
It is. It will be the 32nd. Big number. It's become quite a tradition here in the area. And we've had some interesting people come through over the years that have gone on to some bigger things. So it's been a little bit of a platform for some local acts to maybe get some initial exposure. And we also have a nice mix of people that are established performers around here. So we always try something fresh. We try something new. And we also try and bring back some things that people know. So try and keep that foundation of things and try and keep it fresh for so people will be interested and want to continue to come back, because we've had some people who've come every year, all 32 years.
Wow.
And, it's interesting when you have people share that. I think that's quite the dedication and certainly a show of they've enjoyed.
Well, yeah, it speaks to what you're doing, obviously, and it's so great to hear about an arts festival with such a long history of success and repeat business. I mean, people don't come back year after year unless it's something very exciting. Can you tell us about some of the things you've done in the past before we talk about the future? Some of the people you presented.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, one thing we're doing a little bit different this year. We've tried over the years, like we used to do fireworks, and we had to eliminate fireworks because it's a very expensive 15 minutes, and mm-hmm. we just decided we could do more entertainment that would provide more value to more people. And we've also tried to do a ball drop, but it's very difficult on the mall trying to find a place that will work. So this year we're kind of breaking it down, and we're going to have a couple of events where people can kind of bring in the new year. And we're hoping to start something new this year. We're working with the Newsplex, and we may be we're hoping to be able to work out to stream the last hour of one of our performances on TV, so we can kind of share with the local community, bringing in New Year's in Charlottesville.
Fantastic. That's a great new addition. Tell me, how did you sort of come about, and I assume this happened before you were even with the organization, how did it come about that it was to be alcohol-free?
Well, the first night in Boston was actually an alcohol-free event. That doesn't mean that every restaurant's closed down or that people can't enjoy a beverage if they wanted to during the course of the evening. It's just not something where we try to encourage or that we have any sponsorship from alcohol vendors or anything of that nature, mm-hmm. because the focus is on a broad-based community, family-friendly, something for all ages, mm-hmm. and I think a little bit focused on what many people view as far as New Year's with the champagne and toasting and waking up with a hangover on New Year's Day, and
yes.
We're hoping people will wake up with a smile and say, gosh, that was a great experience. I really got to see a variety of entertainment, and we got to have a nice family evening, and it was a great way to bring in the new year and to celebrate the wrap-up of 2013.
I agree, and it's something the entire family can share. As opposed to, putting everybody to bed early and then staying up. I really hear you on that point. I have, I enjoy vodka, I enjoy wine, but oddly, on New Year's Eve, I drink far less than my friends or than I would on another holiday. And I think it's because of the just what you've said. I just don't like to start the brand new year and all of its potential hungover or blurry-eyed. I'd like to wake up New Year's Day and, okay, here we go. We've got another chance at this. Let's get it right this time, So
absolutely.
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, and I think people enjoy it. I mean, most of the attendance will probably be somewhere between 4,000 to 5,000 people, and given the variety of venues we have, we feel like that should still allow people to be able to get into each of the shows they want to, and for there to be space. And it's a good number because there's a nice synergy around the mall. There's a good buzz. People are enjoying and feeling they're part of a kind of a community celebration, and that's ultimately the goal.
Fantastic. And people come from as far away as Boston.
And farther. We don't actually track all of our travelers. We have had conversation. It's very difficult because there's so many access points for people and trying to capture that. But I try to ask people during the event where they're from, what's going on, and just try and get, if you will, my own local survey. And every year that I've been involved, there's always been people that have come outside of Virginia. So I think that's kind of the exciting thing. And certainly a lot of people will come over from a Harrisonburg or a Stanton. I mean, it's a regional event because the next closest one, Harrisonburg, Respark Bears, Fredericksburg has one. There is one in Northern Virginia, but for the central part of Virginia, there isn't one in Richmond. I don't believe there's one in Virginia Beach. So it's kind of a neat way for people to come up here, and because the Omni's right there, It's easy not to have to go far and stay at a hotel and enjoy a wonderful evening.
Fantastic. So tickets are in the form of a wristband, and they go on sale December 1st?
Indeed. December 1st, you can go and get them online at firstnightva.org, or you can buy from some local vendors. If you buy prior to December 27th online, they can be shipped to your house via mail. And so this will be the first year we've been able to deliver to people's homes. In years past, it had to come down to will call. So this will make for an easier transition for people to get where they want to go. But if they want to buy local, there are some outlets that will be the Blue Ridge Mountain Sports down at Timberlake Drive on the mall. The Discovery Museum is also on the mall. The Paramount Theater. And the Paramount Theater has a special thing. If the wristband will allow you access to any of our venues. But we do a special set of circumstances at the Paramount because there is so much demand for the acts that we have there that if you want to guarantee yourself a seat, it would be $5 per person for a guaranteed seat at the Paramount. But you can always take your chances with the wristbands. And the other venues locally are going to be Plan 9, Estop, Bodo, and Charlottesville Volvo. And we encourage people to try and buy online so you can get them delivered to your house and if you want to do it from the convenience of your computer.
Fantastic. And is there a telephone number?
Yes, there is the phone number for if somebody has any questions or any considerations. Let me get that for you. Give me 1 second, Marcello.
No problem.
I'll pull that back into the conversation. So I think the main thing that we are excited about this year, if I can just give a quick shout out to some of our supporters who make it happen. Certainly the first is the Omni Hotel. They've been a longtime supporter, and that's our primary headquarters, and they have been huge over the number of years. And then the Newsplex has been very good in the promotion for us. I think they're going to try this live streaming this year. We're excited about the potential with that.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Monticello Media. Some of what we're doing right now has been a great supporter for us. And the new one we have this year will be our presenting sponsor is going to be Sloan Manis Real Estate Partners. So they're new coming aboard and came aboard in a big way, and we're excited about that. And let me share the phone number. If anybody has any questions or want to find out more information, the number is 434-975-8269.
Excellent. One more time, if you don't mind.
Sure. The phone number again, it would be 434-975-8269. And the web address is First, F-I-R-S-T, Virginia, spelled out, and then V-A, just the letters V-A, .org.
Fantastic. Tell us a little of what we can expect in the way of entertainment in the time that we have left. I know you're doing a spirit walk and many other things.
Yes. Yeah, we've got 38 different performers. We have over 70 performances. We increased the number of performances this year. So some of the things that we have that are going to be first, as you mentioned, this will be the first time we're working with the Omaha Charlottesville Historical Society, and they're creating some spirit walks. So that will be something new and different. We're also using a new space with the old Metropolitan, and that's going to be cool. We have a singer-songwriter session that's going to be some wonderful people that are going to be participating in that. We try and break up our schedule where the first part of the day we do mix in some things with adult, but a lot of things are kind of geared towards the kids. So we have something like the Youth Orchestra of Central Virginia. We have Daryl Rose kind of doing a drumming session. We have kind of a shortened segment of the Nutcracker Suite performed by the Charlottesville Ballet. And another very cool, neat thing we have this year is the Virginia Acrobatics, which are they're going to be swinging from the ceiling rafters and
wow,
doing some incredible acrobatics. So that'll be a new act for us this year.
That really sounds like a packed evening with lots of fun for everybody, all ages.
It is. I mean, as I said, it would take maybe too long to go through all of these, but there's something from storytelling with Lincoln's Bodyguard to Hamner's Theater doing Shakespeare, We've got James Muncy, who's going to be at the Paramount. He's a hypnotist. We've had him before, and he got rave reviews, and he does some pretty interesting stuff with people up on stage. So I think that will be entertaining on a lot of fronts. And we have a very clean comedian, because comedy isn't always easy to make clean. But Nick Arnett, a national level performer, we're excited to have him in. So I think there's a little bit of something for everyone, and we have more offerings this year than we did last year, so you know, we're really excited about all the possibilities for people to have a great way to wrap up the year and bring in the new year in a sense with the community, and I think people enjoy that aspect.
Fantastic. Speaking of wrapping up, that's going to be all the time we have today to be with the president of Virginia, well, the president of First Night Virginia, Drake Van de Castle, and his great event that's coming up on New Year's Eve 2013 to welcome in the new year of 2014. Tickets in the form of a wristband go on sale on December 1st. You want to be involved in this great family celebration. We're going to say goodbye to Drake now, but don't go away. We here at the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio will be back right after we hear the spoken word from our creative catalyst and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins. Don't go
Save
away.
Save my heart. Play my part. Make my mark. I want to leave my mark forever. Put art together with guilds, weld, melt, and build architecture. Carve curves like carpenters and carpe diem. Construct structures in stucco. Craft columns and coliseums. Les Miserables and mezzanines. Mosaics in museums. I want to create craft stones and statues. Pristine castles like the Sistine Chapel. The ceiling touched with my acrylic brush inside the basilica. I want to make a masterpiece, weave a tapestry in a monastery with a Catholic priest for all those to see who's coming after me. I want to inspire churches and chapels with tin spires and steeples, Gothic cathedrals, painting the saints on easels and empires. I want to paint a palace with my palette. I want to bring goodness like culinary artists bring food to your palate with bottles of wine. I want to model, design, polish, refine with my talent. I want to say my heart. Play my part. Make my mark.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices Blog Talk Radio, where art and politics marry to wake world peace and dynamic productions. My second guest is Patti DeBeck, a Broadway musical theater veteran. Patti DeBeck's credits as associate choreographer, supervisor, dance captain, and actor include the original productions of Applause with Lauren Bacall, A Chorus Line, Seesaw, Pippin with Ben Vereen, Evita, The Will Rogers Follies, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, Annie Get Your Gun, Bells Are Ringing, and Grease. She also choreographed the opening number of the 1997 Tony Awards for Rosie O'Donnell. Patti has worked with many Broadway directors and choreographers, including Tommy Toon, Bob Fosse, Michael Bennett, and Hal Prince, and counts as one of her many, many dear friends, me, Marcello Rolando. Patti, how are you?
Yes, I'm fine, and it is great to talk to you. We need to spend more time, I think, together.
We do. You know,
it's been a while.
Don't tell me the last time we talked was South Carolina, that Southern Arts Conference. Was that it? Last time we saw each other?
Yes, I saw you there. I think that is the last time. We've tried to get together, but, you know, everyone's schedules get crazy, so it hasn't quite worked out. So I'm grateful for this opportunity. Thank you for this today.
Oh, well, I'm grateful, too. It's great to talk to you, and we will do better. Wait until they find out how close we live to one another.
I didn't want to say that.
I know. You know, Patti and I have known each other a long time. Even though we were both in New York at the same time, I don't think our paths crossed there so much as when we were both in Florida. In New York, I was doing television. She was doing Broadway. In Florida, we sort of lived, although I guess I did some film work down there, but I saw her more often than not in Florida. And we're both sort of East Coast, up and down, working all the time. But now, Patti is at VCU, so tell us a bit about that.
Yes, you know, I started started, I'm an assistant professor in the theater department in VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. And I actually started there, when did I start? The fall of 2004. I went down, what happened is I had met the chair, David Leong, working on, I did some auditions with him for the Miracle Worker that was going to come to New York. This was about maybe 2001. It turned out that my schedule didn't permit me to then assist him on the final production. But about a year later or so, he called me and asked me if I would like to be a guest artist at Virginia Commonwealth. And I said, sure. So you come down for a week and you go to classes and you hold workshops for maybe 20 students. And so I was there, and then they asked me in the middle of the week, I guess they must have had an opening, they said, would you be interested in teaching? And I said, well, you know, I've taught before, but never really thought about staying at a place and teaching on a steady basis. And I said, well, let me think about it. So I thought about it, and he said, you know, this was October. And he said, just let me know by the end of the year. And I decided to try it. So I have been there since 04. I teach I teach sophomores movement for the actors, and I have a class of juniors where I teach musical theater performance. They bring in songs. It's really about acting a song, telling a story. Currently, we do not have a full-fledged musical theater program. However, just a few days ago, it looks like we are going to be able to extend that, which I'm really excited about.
So wow.
We do big musicals there. We do big musicals.
Uh-huh.
So, but yeah, so I've been there teaching, and we just finished the production of Hairspray, which in it, let me see, it closes actually this Sunday. So anybody, you know, wants to come to see Hairspray through this Sunday, November, what would that be? 25, I guess.
25, yes.
Okay. Yeah. We're completing our 3-week run.
Wow. Even though it's embarrassing now that I'm actually talking to you to realize how we saw more of each other when we lived further apart. How weird is that? I've been in and out of Richmond many times since 2004 for political reasons, and generally I call Patty on my driving out of town to say, sorry I missed you, and I never told I was going to be there. It's just a crazy life. But let's talk about past life a little bit, too. I don't know if I ever told you this, Patty, but I was once walking, as New Yorkers do, in Times Square, racing to wherever. I was heading east, and this giant of a thin man was heading east, and no one seemed to recognize him, but I did immediately. Can you guess who it was?
Well, I didn't hear everything. Did you say a thin man? Is that what you said?
Tall, thin man. It was Tommy Toon.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. I don't think I've ever told you this story, but I met him at Times Square, walking in the opposite direction, did an immediate 180 degrees, started a conversation with him. He was most pleasant, especially when I said, oh, by the way, I know Patty DeBeck. And I know I've never told you this, I don't think, but his immediate response to me was, oh, Patty, she's my favorite choreographer. Wow, huh?
Oh, he is just lovely. I haven't seen him for a while, but my goodness, my first work with Tommy Toon when he was, and there was a musical called Applause, which is now years ago. It opened, it was a Michael Bennett director, it was 1973. But he came in to choreograph a couple numbers for Michael, and I happened to be the one of the group that was available in the evening that could tap dance. So I ended up, you know, working with Tommy on the tap number that he was creating. And then a few years later, I was a replacement in one of his productions, The Bechdel Whorehouse of Texas. Then my one and only, I joined my one and only with Tommy Toon and Twiggy, which was a Gershwin musical. And then Tommy directed and choreographed the Will Rogers Follies with Keith Carradine, and I was involved in assisting Jeff Calhoun on that. And then what else? Oh, and then he sort of oversaw the production of Grease, the musical that was the one that was revived in 94 that started with Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes.
And then there were workshops with Tommy Tune, Buster Alley, and there was the workshop Easter Parade. They never made it to New York, but there were a number of workshops. And yeah, I've known Tommy for years. Wow.
Yes, yes. And I know I'd never told you that story, but that happened, obviously it happened after we met, it was just a fun moment. I mean, in New York, as you know, you meet everyone walking on the streets. Everybody's walking, you know, even though we're rushing to get from point A to point Z, we see each other and chat and nod and whatever. And as long as you're not bugging someone for an autograph, most very happy to talk to you, especially about the business.
You know, and you do see people all the time, and you certainly don't need a car in New York. It's more in the
no.
But it's funny when you go out and you walk long distances.
Yes.
And it feels like nothing. But then when you go somewhere else, you move somewhere and you're not in the city and you drive everywhere you go, it's funny, even the shortest distances you end up driving, where in New York, you would just think nothing of walking that distance.
Oh, yes. Many, many times in directing shows, I would walk one way or the other, going to the rehearsal or from it in the evening. I'd walk 30, 40 blocks and think nothing of it. But then I moved to Florida. And, you know, and I tried. I've stepped out, but I'm not one for heat anyway. And the first time I went out to take a walk, it was so hot, that was the end of that. I thought I was going to have to shave my legs or something. It was too hot. But another time our paths crossed since our New York days, this is a funny story. I was hired or cast to play, I think, the Bishop Cardinal combination character or something in King Richard at the Shakespeare Theater in D.C. Do you remember this? And... I'm sitting there behind us for what I could see, a very, very lovely lady. But the show was about to start, and there was some kind of soda can in the aisle between her seat and my seat. So I tapped her on the shoulder to see if she wanted it, or if it was hers, if she wanted to keep it, because if not, I was going to get rid of it. And guess who turned around? You could finish that story.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, that was such a surprise. I didn't know.
I know.
And
you were there to see the show and the choreography. Oh God, I can't think of his name now. Give it to me.
David Leong.
Yes. And we hadn't seen each other in quite a while, and here I was going into the show, and they wanted me to see it, and you were there to see it as well, and boom, sitting right behind one another or in front of one another, and when you turned around, I just our jaws dropped.
It is a small world, isn't it?
Especially in theater, especially in the arts.
You know, I'm surprised we haven't passed each other on the highway.
Well, I know seriously, quite literally, as much as we drive up and down the East Coast still, I'm to Philadelphia and D.C. and quite often, and then back to Charlottesville, but most often these days, D.C. and Charlottesville, but I know you run up to even further, don't you, and then back to Richmond?
Yes, you know, for a while, a couple times, I think twice at this point, I have worked, well, no, that's not in the right direction. Is it? See, my geography is not so good.
Yeah.
But I have bounced back and forth to Fredericksburg because there's a wonderful theater there, Riverside Dinner Theater.
Yes.
And I have worked, I know that's not in the same direction as Charlottesville, I have worked there. You know, so I go up and down. I go up and down to D.C., whether it's doing a workshop or visiting family as well. I have family in Arlington and then also outside of Baltimore. But, yeah, at Riverside, we might have spoken during a time of one of those Riverside moments. I directed and choreographed Phantom of the Phantom. It's called Phantom because it's the Mari Yepsen version.
Uh-huh.
And something, oh my goodness, am I losing my, oh yes, Eat Misbehaving. Yes.
Yes, yes. Yes, I know people who've worked at that theater. Now I know you've worked there, so there it is. I get calls a lot about why don't I come over there and work. And I've always preferred directing theater and when I act, acting on camera. And that's just, you know, not that I never perform in theater. I certainly have and enjoyed it. With the Shakespeare, for instance, we were just talking about. That was quite a show. What did you think of that? I don't think you ever saw me in it, but you saw the show, yes?
I don't think I went back. Yeah, no, I don't think so. But,
well, King Richard is a lot to take twice.
But how wonderful that you did that. And I do, again, as I said earlier, I still look forward to seeing you in any capacity, you know, working or visiting or lunch or something.
Well, we are going to do it because we're promising the world right now that we are.
Yeah.
Especially if you, the musical theater department, it grows and evolves down there in Richmond, I'll definitely come with ulterior motives, but lots of love too.
Oh, yes, no, you could come down and do a class. That would be great. I would love it.
That would be fun. That would be fun.
Yes, absolutely.
So, how is it, you know, I mean, people ask me, I hate it when people ask me this, and here I'm asking you. How does it feel working in Virginia after so many years in New York?
You know, I know people ask me that all the time, like, was it a shocker? And, you know, absolutely not. I mean, I went to New York in... This will tell people how old I am. Maybe I shouldn't do that. No, I went to New York in 66, and I was very, I must say, I was very lucky. I worked straight through until, my last Broadway show closed in 2001, which was Annie Get Your Gun, that had Emmett, Bernadette Peters initially, and then David McIntyre came in. And then I did a couple of, you know, things, still in New York, so I basically was there till about 2003. That's an awful lot of time to be in New York.
Yes.
I loved every minute of it, but at the same time, I was going, I kept asking myself, what am I going to do when I grow up?
Yeah, yes, I know the feeling.
I mean, though it's, when work is such fun, I'm not that it isn't work, but you have such fun doing it. You forget that it's work, you know?
Yes.
But I really was ready to... do something else, to go somewhere else, and it was just like, I feel like fate, the gods were taking care of me when this offer came up, and it's something that I, even though I taught at NYU, I at Tate University, it was always while I was doing a Broadway show, and so I've always said my entire life, the one thing I will never do is teach. I mean, I just said I won't. Of course, when you choreograph, when you supervise, you're teaching people,
yes,
all the time.
So
I had some sort of idea of teaching that actually isn't what it is. I love it. And I have to tell you, you know, they say that it's so true. When you teach, you learn so much.
Yes.
I mean, I because the things that I sort of know instinctively or have sort of learned by being in the theater in the professional world, but I when you teach that stuff, you have to name it,
yes,
explain it, and pull it apart for students. And so by doing that, I feel that I'm a better director, you know. I've really learned from your students, and I feel like because I understand specifics more in that I'm able to name them and take them apart. So I have really, really learned more than, hopefully they've learned something from me, but certainly I have learned a great deal from them.
Oh, I'm sure they've learned from you, but I know what you mean. I get that too. From almost all ages, I've worked from 12-year-old to 80-year-olds, and you know, worked with name people as you have. But I find that, as you say, being a choreographer or director, when you are in the position of having not only to create the final product, but to explain it. Because here's the thing I always say to actors. The thing that a director or a choreographer has that is perhaps the most beautiful, pleasant gift is that we have it in our head. We see what we are wanting to build here. It's in our head. But the real talent is that you're talking to people, it's not in their head because you haven't told them yet. You haven't shown them. You haven't directed or choreographed. So you have to get that into their head and heart and body and soul and toenails as well. And when you do that, and as you say, you have to dissect. Or as I often say to actors, if you don't understand why I told you to do something, ask me. And I've also discovered, I'll make another confession. Have you run into this one? If I give actors something to do, this just happened in a show I recently directed that everyone claims stole the night, and I'm pleased. I loved what the women did. They were fabulous. But there was one little bit I gave one of the more seasoned actors, and she kept trying, and it just didn't work, just didn't work, just didn't work. And finally, I got up, and because it was one of these putting it together all in one day, so there wasn't a lot of time to experiment, say. So I got up, and I said, you know what the problem is with this? It's the blocking. It's never the performer. When a performer really, really tries to do what you've asked them to do repeatedly, and it just doesn't work, I find it's because I've given them something that they shouldn't be doing. I should give them something else. And it was a very simple solution, just a little adjustment, and then it just worked like a dream. Have you ever run into that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in doing Hairspray recently at BCU, there was a particular scene that I had a lot of trouble with, and I just and it's in the it's in the thrust. It's three sided.
Yes.
And it's stadium seating, and it's three sided. So, you know, you're always playing on angles, and so to make sure everybody gets a piece of the action and can see what's going on. But there is one thing that just didn't work at all, and we just. Just change one little section of the scene, like one little beat, and by just having a cross somewhere, it just made so much more sense.
And boom, and there it was, right? You know?
Yeah.
Yes, I know. I know. But God bless all those dancers and actors and singers who do their best to do what we ask of them. And you know, and God bless us when we see we need to give them something else because it isn't working.
then you just try something. We all know there's a million ways to do things.
Exactly.
Hopefully, we don't always have the time. Depending on what the rehearsal period is,
yes.
Not always a lot of time to experiment. It's fun if you get to play and it's just a playground and, let the actors find their way. You give them some general ideas and see what they come up with and then you fine-tune it. But oftentimes you don't have that play period, a long play period. And
exactly.
To make quick decisions, yeah.
That's where the classroom is better than the rehearsal room. Although I've been told, as I think you alluded to, people have told me all along, well, when you're directing, Marcello, you're teaching, and when you're teaching, you're directing, because we can't tell the difference. So
right.
Maybe that's true. But I do think in the classroom, especially at the university level, you can get to play, to mold a little, to watch, to discover, and all of a sudden, I tell people that when I go into a rehearsal, I know what I think this show is. But what's beautiful is that the moment the performers get up and just move around and speak, mm-hmm. Well, then it becomes something else, because they brought that to it.
Go ahead.
No, I don't want to cut you off. I'm just saying we probably run out of time. We're having so much time. We have got to see each other. We can't just wait for radio interviews.
And I want to tell you this, that I don't know if I told you, I'm coming from D.C. right now because worked, I assisted the director, Jeff Calhoun, who I worked with on a million projects in New York. Shows. He directed Maurice Hines in Tapping Through Life at Arena Stage that just opened last night.
Yes.
And he, because I sort of live in the area, he called me and said, Teddy, let's work together. You know, I know you're not coming to New York to work on a steady basis, but so it was lovely to work with him and to work with Maurice Hines. Oh, my goodness. Maurice will be 70 December 13th.
Wow.
And he is just tapping his heart out, and it's a wonderful, it's a nightclub performance at its best, but it really is a journey through his life.
Yes.
You know, from a child to working with Gregory to going to Las Vegas to working with all the stars up until the present. It's really a wonderful thing. If you ever get a chance to go see, it runs to December 29th, I think.
Okay. I will definitely get up there. That's beautiful.
But anyway, yes. Well, we will definitely have to get together.
Yes, and everyone, try to get down to VCU and see Hairspray. It runs through this Sunday, November 24th. So you got two more days. Well, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Yes?
Yes, come down and see it.
All right, Patty, thank you so very much. We're going to say goodbye to Patty DeBeck, director and choreographer par excellence from New York City to Fredericksburg and Richmond and all points west. We'd just like to say, while we're saying goodbye to Patty DeBeck, don't go away, everyone else. We will be back with our panel of voices, reasonable voices, Bernard Hankins, Daniel Garner, and Michelle Opperman. Stay with us right after this spoken word. We'll be right back.
I want to be my mark forever. Put art together with guilds, weld, melt, and build architecture. Carve curves like carpenters and carpe diem. Construct structures and suckle. Craft columns and coliseums. Les Miserables and mezzanines, mosaics and museums. I want to create craft stones and statues. Pristine castles like the Sistine Chapel. The ceiling touched with my acrylic brush inside the basilica. I want to make a masterpiece, weave a tapestry in a monastery with a Catholic priest for all those to see who's coming after me. I want to inspire churches and chapels with tin spires and steeples, Gothic cathedrals, painting the saints on easels and empires. I want to paint a palace with my palette. I want to bring goodness like culinary artists bring food to your palate with bottles of wine. I want to model, design, polish, refine with my talent. I want to say my heart. Play my part. Make my mark.
Welcome back to The Reasonable Voices, Blog Talk Radio. And The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me today are our technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins. With Michelle Opperman taking away my breath as usual, and Daniel L. Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Thank you for joining us today. We are we're having an artistic day. As you know, The Reasonable Voice is a blend of politics and politics, or politics and finances, and humanity, world peace, and of course,
this show might
we
not have
believe that the arts can connect and indeed educate all of those. And that's what we're here to talk about. We had Patty DeBeck today, Broadway director, choreographer, friend, and also Drake Van de Kassel, what a name, who is the president of First Night Virginia. So let's, and of course, we do remember it is November 22nd, 2013. So today, Bernard.
Well, as I was thinking about today's show, the main thing I was thinking about was, you know, when most people hear the word about art, they automatically self-exclude themselves because they think, well, I'm not an artist. Partially, I think it's based upon what we've done in our kindergarten on up. We've just removed art. But to me, you know, thinking about art, I think everyone should look to art not so much for can I paint, can I draw, but things like how does this make me more empathetic? You know, when you write a story, when you create a piece of art, you're always thinking of how is someone else going to see this, or you're putting yourself in someone else's shoes to be able to view something that you are not able to view just naturally, and that's what art helps you to do. It helps you put on this new lens, this new perspective. So I think if people start to think not just hearing the word art and automatically assuming that it means painting or drawing, but this broader range of a new type of feeling or way of engaging people.
And Neil Gaiman, who wrote American Gods, had an interesting article on how when people don't read books, they're less empathetic. I mean, Daniel Goldman, you know, emotional intelligence has that. And, Daniel Pink, I think, Holden and Mine talks about that as well. No, I totally agree. And I think, too, with art, you know, it's like the art of motorcycle maintenance, that famous book, or the art of making chairs. There's a craft that's part of it that I think in our... Perhaps our culture of mass production, of just making something that functions, we lose that sense of the craft that should be involved in making things when it comes to education. And what there was that book that was about, they kind of did a study between restaurants that you know, were average and, you know, were about the same in the quality of their food, but the restaurant that was more aesthetically pleasing did a lot better. And I think a lot of times we forget that there actually is a real, quote-unquote, you know, utility in art. Not that that's the reason you do it, but people really, really need it, and they seek it, and they want it, and that it greatly pays off in empathy, the development, and in the development of craft.
Yeah, I think the question, too, to consider with what Daniel and Bernard have brought up is that sense of, like, why is it important that one would be able to see themselves as an artist? You know, why does it matter? You know, like, oh, okay, well, people don't usually think of themselves as artists. Okay, well, why is that detrimental? But I think it is. It could be beneficial, but I think it's actually detrimental because we, you know, we're actually all creative as individuals, and we really need to be able to own that in a sense, you know, and really believe in ourselves, because being creative, not only can that help you in a you know, in an economy that's down, you know, but also being creative can help you live your life better. You know, I was reading a book by Spencer Johnson. He wrote the book Who Moved My Cheese? And he was talking about how your peaks are
peaks and valleys.
Peaks and valleys of life. And he was talking about essentially your peaks are when you have the right attitude. Your valleys are when you don't, or you focus on what you're missing. So I think, like, even in that, considering life and how you can live a better life, actually to be creative is to be able to see things not for what they are, in a sense, and that takes being creative. So I think it is actually fundamental that we really own and be more comfortable with being ourselves, artists.
I think we have to see, you know, the old cliche, the half-full glass as opposed to the half-empty one. But when I, as we all know, I've said it so many times, probably everyone listening knows as well, that the way I relax is that I get on the back roads and do 40 with God. And it doesn't matter to me if it's a sunny, crisp, beautiful fall day. That's my favorite, to be sure. But if it's a cloudy day, it's still a wonderful ride. You know, it's still all there. It's just a different color, a different shade, but it's still beautiful. So, you know, the creation is creating, and we are all creators in it. I'm particularly grateful to the two guests we had today, because we do a lot of politics, and it's nice to get back to the connection that I do believe is there for politics and artists. And I think artists can make politics honest. Maybe not politicians, but we can certainly make politics honest. We can make it transparent. We can paint it. We can talk about it. We can write about it. You know, we can do all those things, and that's necessary. What I know, this is like, what is the point in on a day that we may be running a little behind schedule? But what are we going to do about the arts cut out of the public education system? My high school music teacher launched my career. That is not a euphemism. She knew people who knew people who knew people, and she recognized my talent, and bang. Why? Because I was in her choir class. She got to meet me and teach me. What are we going to do about that?
I don't know if I have that answer right away. I've thought about it a lot, but I kind of wanted to go back to empathy.
You got it.
Because I gave a talk. We created this event, you know, Daniel, Michelle, and I, called Pitchcraft, which took myself, a poet, an entrepreneur, an actor, and a comedian, and they all talked about the idea of pitch. And one of the points that I didn't get to make there was this idea of, you know, whenever you're presenting on stage, you're always told, be confident. It's like, well, if it was that easy, everybody would be confident. So I wanted to talk about how if you think about empathy, which most people don't think about, it actually could get you to confidence. Because if you put yourself in the shoes of the audience, you're not going to say, hey, I hope this guy fails. I hope he doesn't know what he's talking about. I hope I spent all my money and invested my time and gas to come here so that he looks incoherent. So even, you know, if people don't want to talk about art, they need to understand that, like, bringing those values which art infuses, such as empathy, are beneficial to business. Yeah. Like, if you're a pitch person and you want to know how to pitch and you want to know how to get on stage and be confident, there are things that you can learn from actors and actresses and comedians and poets who can help you better present your idea. Because I think what you're talking about, I think because that has been removed, I mean, everybody knows the, like, Louis C.K. recent thing where he talked about he doesn't let his kids have cell phones because it doesn't teach empathy.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a comedian on TV telling you. This is not a politician or a doctor. You have a comedian talking to you about empathy.
Well, I think to combine those points, when you make the arts extracurricular rather than primary, then you imply empathy is extra. It's not necessary. Craft is extra, it's not necessary. So it's not by chance that your political discourse, your public discourse becomes less empathetic, it becomes more obnoxious, it becomes less well-crafted, and it kind of devolves into exclamation marks on YouTube comments. I think, too, Ken Robinson has a lot to say on education. There's also a man from, I think, India who lives in Britain. I can't think of his name, who's done a lot of research. There's a TED Talk on it. It won the best TED Talk of 2013. Maybe if our listeners are interested, they can listen to that. He talks about this issue. And I think... when it comes to the necessity, you can't be a full person if you don't really have appreciation of creativity, because it's within you, it's part of you, it's who you are. So when you don't have a school system that is teaching kids that creativity is important, there's a way in which you have a school system that's alienating kids from themselves, because it's not valuing a part of them. And then they end up just going home and making kind of crazy YouTube videos of planking and things like that. Bernard and I wrote a paper called Should We Get Rid of the Internet? How Culture's Attitude Toward Art is Just as Absurd. That goes to these questions. That can be found on ogrose.com. Mr. Hankins was quite brilliant in that.
Yeah, well, I think when it comes to the school system, you know, you can talk about endless hypotheticals as a solution, but I think something has brought up, which is just generally, you know, I think is a good start, or, you know, perhaps it's almost like having, you can fill in all the blocks, you can use Legos and create different structures, right? But it's the fact that you're using the right type of Lego, in a sense. It's almost like the fact that you recognize creativity as a natural part and a healthy part of our existence. And I think schools should be the place where kids are really afforded that opportunity. And, you know, I was just talking to a girl I babysit, she's in high school, and it's just there's a frustration, I think, that comes with being in school. You know, you want to learn, and you're very an interested person, and you want to engage and be engaged, and yet school just makes you feel like overwhelmed, and, you know, there's a sense of it just feeling endless, and there's a sense of just cramming stuff into your head and then regurgitating it, which I know this is the common thing that's talked about, but then why isn't anything happening? Why is it like, why isn't anything changing? I don't understand, you know, so that's what I would have to say, but I'm all for being creative in school and also being creative about how to do school.
Sure. Well, you know, I wonder if, I'm not trying to oversimplify, obviously there are a lot of different pressures in society than when I was a kid, but I do think recess and art classes and music classes and dance classes were ways, if not to discover your own creativity, which they were certainly ways of release, of relax, of taking a pause. I've got to some point tell you the story that makes my wife and I laugh so much about pause, but we don't have enough time today. But we'll do it in another panel discussion. But the point is, life all around us is creating something, and it is, as Daniel says, it is connected to us. We are connected to it. So to deny it, or to shut it down for the larger part of a child's day, cannot be a smart thing to do.
Right. And I always think it's funny, and I'm going to write this down in some form, but I always think it's funny how when you're a kid, it's looked upon as a good thing to be like, good job, you can do it. But as soon as you hit like 12, it's like there's no more of this kind of soft, you know, tone of voice saying like, you can make it, you can follow your dreams. And it's like, why is it that we nurture kids up to this level and then just cut it off?
Yeah.
And you're like, you're saying that's very detrimental, because if this creativity doesn't come out in a healthy way, guess what's going to happen when kid goes home? They're like, oh, what's up in the basement in the attic? I wonder how I can combine these two things.
All right. Well, I think we're going to call it a day for today, but we're glad you joined us. The Reasonable Voices in the studio with me today are technical support creative catalyst and spoken word poet Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Upperman and Daniel L. Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Thank you for joining us today and recommending us to all your friends. I am the Reasonable Voice, Marcello Rolando, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.
No strings attached, no looking back. A new man is what you're looking at. Giving up.